Hey, welcome to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques. So we're going to try to get some of that. I am Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, college educator, stand-up and late-night comedy writer from Hollywood, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. I also do a lot at Substack. You can pop over there and read things like Persuasion for Parents, Train Your Kids to Say Yes, which my kids were 20-year rhetoric experiments. So they should get some of the residuals, as if there were some. On the podcast, the Rhetoric Warriors podcast lives at the intersection of entertainment and what I call useful academics. I really love trying to take sort of talk show entertainment structures and fill them up with real talk and see what happens. I talk to three different types of people. I talk to comedians about their careers and their politics, because God knows where those minds are going to go. I convert conservatives on here because the right worries me. Come back to democracy, y'all. The door's open. And I talked to many, many academics, persuasion pros, and rhetoricians, more rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast in the world. My guest today has done a million things, all of them cool. I was really enjoying reading his background online. He's one of those guys that has gone through academics, I think, and surfed the academic world very well. So I could talk to him endlessly. He's a cognitive scientist, UT professor, blogger, author, podcaster, and now the vice provost. I love all this title. Vice provost for continuing and professional education and new education ventures at UT Austin. Art Markman.
Art. Dan, it is great to be here.
How's it going? And are you over at UT today?
I am. I am in my office here at the University of Texas. I'm actually, the building that we're in is a little bit south of campus. And so I actually have to walk a little way if I want to see an actual student. But it's close enough.
Yeah, I taught, the last time I taught over there was, I taught TV writing for a while, and they put me on in the old communication building in, I think, half a closet. And it was actually kind of fun, because I'd gone there 20 years before in that department as a grad student, and then came back and taught some. And it was all the same professors. It was Chirwitz, it was Hart, it was Daly. They had just aged 20 years.
And oddly enough, you hadn't aged a bit.
Not at all. That's the twilight zone of experience. Everybody else ages and you just kind of like,
That's right.
So you've done tons of stuff. We kind of cross over, I think, in cognitive science and rhetoric a little bit, but I'm really interested in the your job as vice provost. Do you want to explain to everybody what that means?
Yeah, so let's attack that from two different directions. First of all, nobody understands the academic hierarchy very well, so let's zero in on that. The top two leaders at a university like University of Texas would be the president of the university, who really sets strategic direction, does a lot of fundraising, and is the final decision maker on pretty much everything that happens. And then the provost, who is the chief academic officer, basically, and has the entire academic mission under that portfolio. And then just like presidents have vice presidents, provosts have vice provosts, who take on particular elements of the way that the university functions. And like many universities, University of Texas is doing a lot more work in the area of continuing and professional education, recognizing that it's not just 18 to 22 year olds and the traditional kind of PhD student, but also executive master students and people who are coming back to take one day programs and certificate programs, boot camps and things like that. And so that's a part of the portfolio. That's the continuing and professional education part. But as I began, this is actually the first time that the university's had someone in this position. And so they asked me as part of stepping into the role was to figure out what the role was going to be. And I realized that as you begin to figure out how to do that sort of education effectively, it actually influences the way we do everything, and how we might use technology better to teach, how we might try to be more innovative in the way we teach everybody. And so I added these weasel words, new education ventures, that just allow me to play wherever else I feel like it.
Yeah, good strategy. Like you don't want to shut, you want to have open shoots everywhere in case you want to pivot at any moment.
That's right. I don't want somebody saying, no, that's not your lane. I'm like, you kidding me? It's all my lane.
Yeah, no, I totally understand this. I think that was my sort of thing about starting the Rhetoric Warriors podcast is I'd taught at universities off and on for, 20 years, and teaching 18 to 20 year olds clearly has value. But when the pandemic hit and Trump hit and all these things, and I'm like, you know what? People need rhetoric skills, and most of the adult population has never even heard the word used in the context of academics. So let me see if I can set something up to do some, information dispersal in a different way. So when I see universities trying to make those adaptations, and you've got this long history of a medieval institution with all its architecture, like the word provost, who knows where that was inherited from? Probably the Germans. Somewhere.
Yeah, and frankly, as I've been saying to everybody, if you put Harry Potter robes on the faculty, it'd be hard pressed to tell the difference between the way we're teaching now and the way we did in the 15th century.
That's exactly right. And you feel it kind of as a professor. Expectations
and but I think we have to change the way we're doing things. We have to change who we're teaching and how we're teaching them.
So, what are your thoughts on that? Like, what are your wild thoughts that you've sort of you probably have your outer ring of wild thoughts, and then you're maybe we can do these, and then I know we can do these.
Well, I think there's a couple of tiers. I mean, across the board in education, we have to make it more active. I do a podcast called Two Guys on Your Head with a buddy of mine named Bob Duke. And one of the things he points out a lot with respect to education is that education, we know that learning is an active process, and we're so bad at it at universities that we nail the seats to the floor.
You
can't be active at all. Right. I mean, you can sort of twist your body back and forth. And so, I think we need to find ways to add more engagement into the way that people are learning, and technology can support that. There's no reason why you can't engage with a fair amount of the lecture type material before you get to class, to have textbooks that are more interactive, that have more exercises in them, that force you to do some things while you're learning, and then use the class time for more guided discussion, more engagement, more working through complex problems, teaching people teamwork. One of the things I talk about a lot is that education is an individual sport, but life is a team sport. And we don't really teach people how to do that kind of interaction. And, because in education, everybody's worried about, well, what if I do all the work? Then, how's that going to affect my grade relative to everybody else's? Well, someday you're going to go out, you're going to work for a company or another organization. If that organization fails, even though you did great work, you don't get an A, you're still out of a job. So it's really important to learn how to work together. And we don't teach those kinds of skills because it's hard to do. But if we had more engagement in classrooms together that wasn't taken up by the traditional what we often call sage on a stage, then you'd have the time to do more of that kind of engagement and teamwork. So that's that's low hanging fruit as far as I'm concerned. And I think that you don't have to be the technology doesn't have to be wild, right? You don't have to create some kind of crazy immersive 3D environment, cool though that might be, in order to teach better. You just have to create more opportunities for people to work together. That's one piece of it. Another thing that would be great to do is to merge the streams of continuing education and traditional undergraduate education in ways that would get undergraduates interacting with knowledgeable people. I've often joked that it's fun to teach undergraduates in part because they don't know anything yet. They've obviously got a knowledge base, but they don't have a lot of life experience to filter it through. And so it's nice sometimes to have people to be teaching people who have a lifetime of experience already and can bring that to bear on the conversation. And I've often felt like the undergraduates that I teach would benefit from being part of a conversation in which they also hear from people who are not academics by nature, but have a lot of really great, valuable experience that they've brought their intellect to over the years. And I think that would just change the nature of some of the conversations that we have.
Yeah, I totally agree with all this. Like, I know I've moved between three different worlds pretty much my whole career of hardcore entertainment. I started as a stand-up when I was in my early 20s and traveling the country and doing biker bars. I would do stand-up anywhere. And versus over here, I got my master's at UT at about the same time, and I started teaching at the University of Louisville. And, you know, over here, you're teaching an academic version of public discourse. And over here, you're living it on the weekends where you're walking into the Silver Dollar and you got to talk for an hour and keep people happy. Yeah. And that activated learning, like, there is no stronger learning than, oh, I'm in trouble if I don't do this well, versus the sort of, you know, the really strong parts of the academic world of pulling out every piece of, you know, micro information and really thinking it through. When those merge, there's no stronger way of doing learning, right?
Yeah. And I think that giving students that opportunity to really try stuff out, you know, in an environment, hopefully, that's a little bit less dangerous than a stand-up environment, you know.
Full danger all the time.
You know, I'm not sure every student wants to be heckled, but it's, you know, but I do think that having that chance to try something out, to work it out on the road a little bit is really useful, you know, and I think that we don't give students enough opportunities to learn to communicate effectively, because, I mean, for two reasons. One, because students come to college and they think that they have to write in a way that nobody writes, and to use words that nobody uses to be impressive. And I keep trying to tell my students, look, just say it in a way that I understand it. I promise you I'll be impressed. The other thing that's weird about the college experience is that you can go through, you know, almost 16 years of education from kindergarten through the end of college before the first time that somebody asks you a question that they don't already know the answer to. Yeah. You know, which is, talk about rhetorical strangeness. You know, can you imagine somebody walks up to you on the street and says, excuse me, what time is it? You say, it's 2:15. They say, exactly right.
You got some good jokes in here, man. You worked out some of this routine. I like it.
So this is, you know, so, but what would you do, right? I mean, it's, you know, life is about answering questions nobody's got the answer to yet. And it requires that period of time where you have no idea what to do and to be okay with that, you know, because part of it is, if I ask you a question and you know I already know the answer, you know, you'll think about it for a minute, then you'll be like, all right, what is it? But, you know, or let me look it up. But if nobody knows the answer yet, then what we have to do is to become comfortable with not knowing, become comfortable with uncertainty. And people aren't good at that. Think about what's happened these days now with IMDb, right? You know, it's ruined the conversation of, wait, who is that actor?
Yeah.
You know, you don't puzzle over it for 10 minutes. No, you look it up. And people, that mentality pervades everything in academia right now. And so we need to create circumstances in which people become comfortable with, yeah, I don't really know the answer to that. I'm going to look it up. I'm going to think about it. And eventually I'm going to come up with something.
Well, and I think your earlier point about the difference between an academic environment as a learning environment and real life, like my other careers working with businesses and doing persuasion consulting, that's adapted down to very specific institutions and occupations where there are not pre-made answers, and they are constantly cycling between the wrong answer, mm-hmm. the partially wrong answer, and then maybe the right answer. There's never a guaranteed correct answer. And people who get out and work for a living know this, and they learn it very quickly. And it's a lesson they do not ever sway away from.
Yeah.
And so that kind of knowing that you're trying to get to good answers, but there's never a perfect answer, and you're always in process. Yeah. I think it's something that's, you're right, students aren't taught that because it's a pre-made environment where there are endpoints of answers.
Well, and also because, you know, we do another disservice, because what we do is we give, let's say, three exams over the course of a semester, and then we average the score on those three exams. And the problem with that is in life, you don't need to get an A on every exam. You need to get an A on the final. Right. So, yeah. So, I mean, we're building a web site for our continuing and professional education programs, because UT has, we have individual programs across the university where we teach. So our business school, our College of Liberal Arts, our engineering school, we have great programs in those colleges, and there are separate websites for each. But if you wake up today and think, gosh, I want to go to the University of Texas and take a continuing education course, by February, you'll be able to come to one website and find everything. Right now, you can't. The team, when we put together the team that was going to build that website, the first thing I told them is, we're aiming for a B minus on the first version of this, right? So don't get paralyzed by thinking we have to have the perfect website on the first day. We want a B minus, because that B minus is going to be better than the F that we're getting right now.
Sure.
And that B minus will teach us a lot, so that the next revision of it will be a B plus or an A minus, and we'll have an A within 6 or 8 months. And that's the way life works. But you know, if you think about the way we teach students, they think they have to get an A on everything. And they don't. And we have to teach them, no, you're gonna do a version of this, and then you're gonna do another, and then you're gonna do another. And by the third one, it's gonna be great.
Yeah, I think back, I have a 19-year-old son who never liked traditional education. Like, he was an online kid from the get-go, very good at tech, and got interested in video and taught himself video editing and special effects online through YouTube, totally free. And that kind of point of need, point of super interest learning, but also that kind of instant access to multiple instructors. Like, you never take a class where you walk in and there's 30 people up there and you're like, I don't like that one, that one, that one, that one, this one.
Yeah.
And until you find the one that matches the way you like your information and gives you the quality of information. So it's this, again, prepackaged experience that you walk into and you have to adapt to it instead of adapting it to you.
Yeah.
And he just flew through it. He just took a job with Epic Games as a, you know, video editor, completely self-taught, 19 years old, and is in a high profile job because of that kind of educational access.
Yeah. But I will say, one of the things that does worry me is that it's really easy to learn skills on the internet. So, I want to learn to get this effect, if you're doing video editing, or I want to learn I want to learn to use this tool. What's hard to do is to learn the mindset that's associated with effective problem solving in a domain. And I think, the reason that I think even in this environment, there's still tremendous value for the 4-year college degree or the 2-year master's program is because there is some value in immersing yourself in a kind of problem solving that enables you to solve the problems that no one's defined well yet. And I think that's the thing that can be really difficult to get from watching a bunch of videos. And colleges need to do a better job of making clear that that's one of the critical things that we teach. We use language that nobody understands, like critical thinking. I don't know what critical thinking is. I mean, it's a word that we throw around a lot, but I do think that if I could help you to define the problems that you're trying to solve better, if I could teach you to identify the places where a particular solution has gone wrong, if I can help you to understand why those things went wrong, and then work you through a process of figuring out how you could do it differently, that's the sort of thing that I think college education can provide, does provide. But we often don't tell the students that that's what we're doing. We it's as if it's a mystery novel that at the end all will be revealed, except that nobody gets to the last chapter and hears hears the long monologue where they tell you what happened. I think we have to start from the beginning and explain, look, this is what your education is about. And a lot of that experience is, and also help people to understand that the reason that you have to learn all kinds of stuff is because you don't know where the next insight's going to come from. And so I often talk about how part of the problem with every college course is that it starts with a syllabus. And I don't mean that that's a bad thing. It's just that part of what having a syllabus communicates to students is that the instructor knows what it is that you need to know in order to be successful later. And we don't know everything you're going to need to know. And so it's because you never know which piece of information is going to be valuable. It's led me to the answer that I currently give to students when they ask me my least favorite question as an instructor. So you could probably guess this, but the least favorite question is this going to be on the exam? And I hate that question. And again, I hate it because how do I know what you're going to need to know? So now, literally, when students say to me, is this going to be on the exam? What I say is yes, but it might not be my exam.
Another good line, man. Got some, you know.
I'm working on it.
Aphoristic, kind of very, you know, choppy, punchy. Yeah, that's late night writing, man. That's,
it's, you know, but if you're going to get people to remember the key points, you got to, wrap them up.
And again, because I've moved so strongly through these three worlds, and if you move through entertainment for a long time, especially in Hollywood, you get into this pipeline production model for messaging. And Hollywood has locked down creative processes because they've been doing it for 75 to 100 years. And then you go out and you realize nobody's harvesting from all the stuff that they've developed. Mm-hmm. And so, like, to me, like this crashing together of entertainment, which I think you're clearly doing, you know, you've got experience in this and short punchy lines, little short stories, all these things, which everybody looks at with such derision from the kind of long form debate, like, oh, it's just sound bites. I'm like, you realize how hard it is to write a good sound bite? Like, yeah. You can control the narrative. You can control the discussion if you have good writers, because you're going to be popping lines and then you're actually in the game. And so when you blend that entertainment structure into things like education or like this, like the podcast format, I think is a great way to do like the deeper learning that you're talking about, the sort of the more abstract conceptual thought processes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and to your point, right, it was Pascal, I think, was the one who said this letter would have been shorter, only I didn't have the time.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, you really have to understand something very deeply in order to be able to turn it into something that can be said briefly and clearly. And I think that people don't recognize that. I mean, a really good soundbite is one that has been thought through so carefully that it distills something really important. And part of the reason that humor works so well is, particularly if you are like me, a psychologist, is that a lot of that humor rests on a recognition of something that's fundamentally true about people's experience. And so they recognize something true and somewhat absurd about the way that their life works that you point out. And to me, I think that's, you know, that's one of the reasons that I have always liked humor as a vehicle for helping people to have some insights about their own psychology, because it helps them to recognize, oh, that's really strange. Yeah, I've always done that without thinking. And yet, how weird.
Yeah. And people are used to it, you know, and people don't protect themselves from humor.
Right.
Like they actively seek it out. And they're used to professional humor. Like I tell people, you know, by the time you see somebody, especially a super pro stand-up, do something on TV, they have cooked that probably 2, 3, 4, 500 times on real stages around the country. And the audience, it's the best type of creativity to develop stand-up, because you write something, you go up and the audience edits for you mercilessly. They will tell you every iota of what's wrong with that. You go back, fix it, redo it. And by the time you're done that kind of close feedback loop through those developmental cycles, it's going to sing. And academics, you know this too. Like once you teach a class 2, 3, 4 times, then you've got the stories, you've got the examples. Yeah. But that first couple of times, you're like, you can feel it's missing when you're in the middle of the lecture. Like, I didn't quite hit that.
Right. This is not landing with them at all. And that's actually one of the reasons why for people who had to teach during the pandemic, why that was so hard, because, you know, if you teach on Zoom, then what you get is this big Hollywood Squares or Brady Bunch, depending on your generation. But you get the layout. And then one of the things that I think a lot of people don't realize is at the college level, most students don't turn their camera on. So you have a whole sea of blank screens. No idea if any jokes are landing, no idea if there's any understanding happening. You don't get quizzical looks on people's faces. I mean, the kinds of things that you could do if you were teaching a class with 30 or 50 or 100 students in it in a room and you could read the room, none of that happens. And it's really hard to do that kind of teaching. But it's on the one hand, but on the other hand, to get back to what we were talking about at the beginning, we shouldn't be teaching like that in the first place. I mean, what we really need to be doing is creating a couple of videos that people could watch of some of the key points, some stuff for people to read, and then to create smaller group environments where people can work together and not always with the instructor. I mean, one of the things that formats like Zoom do provide is opportunities to get four or five people together in a group to work through something and to have a conversation and to create a product as a result of that interaction that then the instructors and other folks can look at and provide feedback on.
Yeah, and I think that multimodal type of learning is a natural life structure, right? You know this in grad school. A lot of the things that you pick up and remember the deepest learnings are the conversations with somebody else who's in an allied area, but in a totally different direction. You're like, oh no. Wow, like I remember my friend Jim Mackin in grad school. He got very interested in the Greeks, you know, the whole Greek rhetoric tradition, and taught himself Greek so he could read it. And then he would tell me what it actually, you know, how he would have interpreted this. And like, I would never have gotten that. He doesn't have any books about it, you know. So that kind of multimodal spread out learning, I think groups are interesting. I remember the first day I started working in TV, I had to do group pitching for jokes. And it was taking sports news, like a lot of talk shows just taking the news and turning it into humor. And it was a sports show. So I literally walked in an hour and a half late because of LA traffic to my first day. I'd never met anybody on the staff and I had to walk into the middle of the creative meeting. So, you know, you have to be a comic. So I walked in like, what, you started without me? This is unacceptable. But within 5 minutes, I was having to pitch to a room full of 10 people. I'd never done that kind of committee work. I was a stand-up, which is a very isolated type of creativity, but it instantly splintered my skills and raised everything up. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of multimodal learning, as universities explore that, it's an endless set of options.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's right. I think those conversations are important. You know, it's also the direct feedback that you get from somebody when you're in a conversation with them is very different. Where then when you're, you know, even if you're doing stand-up and there's an audience, the audience feedback is still somewhat indirect. It's immediate, but you don't get to stop and say, wait a second, why didn't that work for you?
Yeah, it's not that dialogue, right? Yeah.
No. Whereas, you know, if you say something to a friend or a colleague and they don't understand, you can say, okay, where did that go wrong? What did I, you know, what didn't work? And picking that apart, you know, which is something that certainly in academia, we do a lot of. We, you know, you say something, you try to formulate an argument, it and somebody thinks, well, that's not quite right. You actually are willing to take the time and pick it apart. Like, which of the assumptions that I just made didn't work? And learning to unpack those assumptions is critical, whatever you're trying to do. I mean, you can take a joke that wasn't funny and make it funny if you understand which of the assumptions you were making that didn't fly. And I think that works within, you know, you teach persuasion. It's this, you know, that the same thing can work. Okay, so that argument wasn't persuasive to you. Well, what was going on there? What did I get wrong?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of I think actuated learning, where you get actuated information, right? It's at the moment, it's with a real person. You can make adjustments to it, as opposed to these, which sometimes good educated guesses, but it's still guesses from a distance.
Yeah,
yeah. It's fascinating. So is UT, would you call UT, like, I know like MIT was early on this boat and a lot of places trying to open up free courses and things like that. What's UT's status with that? I mean, you're talking about just now putting together kind of a mothership entity for, you know, that kind of learning, but.
Well, we have, as I was saying earlier, we have this very federated model. We have lots of great schools within the university. We have, you know, the College of Liberal Arts, the College of Natural Sciences, the School of Engineering. And each of those programs is excellent. And many of them have programs that aim to teach innovatively or aim to teach non-traditional students. What we haven't done as effectively is to benefit from all of the ideas that are happening by making sure that everybody's talking to each other. And so there isn't a great mechanism for making sure that an insight we get in one college is transferred over somewhere else, and that we share that knowledge, and that we make the things that we're doing visible to the outside world as well. And so a lot of what we're doing is coordinating activity. I spend a lot of time, people look at me sometimes, they think you must hate your job because you spend all your time in meetings. But I don't spend my time in pointless meetings. I spend my time in meetings that involve lots of people who are doing really cool things, bringing them together to talk and to share ideas and to capture insights from that. And then to try to figure out how to use what emerges from that to influence on a broader scale the way that we're teaching. So I really enjoy that kind of work. I like helping people to do the things that they do and have a bigger impact as a result of that.
Have you guys looked at the like Hollywood studio model? Because this is making me think of a Hollywood studio that essentially.
In what way?
Because you have Universal or Warner Brothers, and on top of them is the studio, the execs making sort of the mothership kind of decisions. And then the layer below that are production companies and productions that they'll make deals with. And inside of each of those are creatives and, you know, all their team, all their production team. And so it becomes this kind of way of, under one umbrella, like you're saying, have all the creatives and they're doing very different things, but it's all within that industry. It's just one of the ways that they structure it like that. I'd be curious to see your reaction to it if you look at that structure.
Yeah, I think one of the big differences that we have relative to that kind of model is that in, you know, the big studios have big piles of money that they get to allocate from the center outward to projects. And so one of the big differences in the way a university like University of Texas is structured is that the money generally flows through that next tier down. So the colleges and the schools have the money, and the center doesn't really have a ton of money of its own. What it has is the ability to coordinate and then use smaller amounts of money to create incentives to do new things. So it's a somewhat different model, but the idea that there is a layer of management that has to be skilled at looking across several different kinds of projects that look different on the surface in order to figure out what should be pursued and how you might draw lessons from one of those for another. Mm-hmm. I think that is similar, right? So, you know, if you think about a comedy versus a dramatic movie versus an action film, on the surface, they look very different, but underneath there's a certain degree of commonality across those, and a good high-level executive needs to be able to see that commonality and compare what appear to be apples and oranges in order to make good decisions. And I think that is something that has to happen at the upper tier of administration at universities. And I think it's one of the things that makes it difficult for people to make that leap from, you know, academic institutions are self-governing, for better or for worse, right? You know, I usually say we people who are creative tend to be fairly low in the personality characteristic of conscientiousness. Because conscientiousness, which is both, do you finish the stuff you start, but also do you follow the rules? And you know, to be creative, you can't follow all the rules, which is why lots of academics are slobs and, you know, write with bad handwriting and their desks are a mess and all that. But they're creative. And then we're a self-governing institution, which means we take, you know, these people low in conscientiousness, like me, and we put them in charge.
Right.
And then you wonder why things move so slowly. So that's, I mean, that's fundamentally the structure, but one of the things that's really difficult is how do you get people to make the leap from being a professor to being an administrator within their field of expertise, right? So if you do any administrative work, you tend to, for example, start by being a department chair. You know, I ran a program, it's a similar kind of thing. And so you're still working with people who do more or less the same sort of thing you do. And then maybe if you really have a, you know, you just, you, if you're a masochist, I guess you become a dean, you know, and, but even as a dean, you're working with people because the dean runs a college. And so the dean and the people in the dean's office are still working with people who more or less do the same kind of academic work. They're just doing it, you know, they're just looking at several different kinds of departments. But to go any higher than that, you've now got to leave a lot of your specific expertise behind. You can't think like, I mean, I'm a psychologist. You can't think like a psychologist anymore. You now got to think broadly about, well, so what is somebody in engineering or in right. nursing? Or and that's harder to do. You know, you have, because now you have to see what problems do all of these people who are in such fundamentally different areas of scholarship, what are the problems that they have in common? And that's a harder task to do. And I think a harder leap to make.
Yeah. My experience in education was interesting. I like education. I was in it for a long time just because I enjoyed it so much. The power structures and the politics of education and institutions, for me, like Hollywood worked better for me mm-hmm. because it is a more rebel oriented, you know, it's clear meritocracy. There's very few borders between what people do. You can move quickly into other things. But I sometimes think of these, my experience in these kind of big titan, you know, sort of architectures of an industry like education and entertainment. And now you're seeing politics, you know, because it's gotten this new sort of battery, you know, charge in it, just lumbering over into everybody else's institution and mm-hmm. just throwing its weight around everywhere. And I try to tell people like, you know, well, politics is a horrible way of talking if you're trying to do education or information. And a lot of ways it's a horrible way of talking if you're trying to do entertainment. Because as soon as you start adding in like political judgments of your entertainment and all the social issue stuff and everything else, it locks your creativity up, you know? And so like I have this,
by the way, the founding fathers would have said politics was a lousy way of governing too. I just want to point that out.
Yeah. Isn't that what the one was like, Franklin was like, well, you've got a republic now, good luck keeping it, you know, democracy.
Yeah, well, and you know, as they were framing the Constitution, I mean, they didn't want political parties. They, you know, that was because they thought that was going to lead to the kind of partisanship that was going to stifle problem solving.
Yeah, as a rhetorician looking at it, and I never really did politics again until, you know, Trump broke everything open. I was like, yeah, you want to keep your politics separate from everything else because it's going to just try to take over all your other formats like religion does. Yeah. And so you've seen a lot of that. And I think the educational, I'm really fascinated by what your experience of that is like now trying to do something that's opening up the university to more, you know, people coming in from the adult world and things like that. Does it feel like that's somehow a little riskier than having 18 to 22 year olds in there all the time or?
You know, yes and no. I mean, it's I think anytime you change anything, it feels risky, but I think on the one hand, I think it's really valuable because it forces all of our faculty to really think a lot about what they know. Because the questions you get from a 45-year-old who's a successful executive in a company are much different and much better than the questions that you get from the typical 19-year-old in a class. Because not only have they got a wide base of life experience, they've also, you know, typically they've got a college degree and they've read and thought about a bunch of things. And so they're not going to take glib answers to hard problems. they really want you to dig in. And so you've got to really be very sure about what you know, and to be really prepared to teach in that environment. And more importantly, you have to be really integrative in the stuff that you know. So a lot of academics, particularly at tier one research universities like the University of Texas, we are researchers first and then teachers. And that's okay. I mean, I think having people who live at the cutting edge of research and are teaching you in your class can be great, because it means that they really are aware of the nuance of all of the latest work. But there is one danger, and that is that if you want to publish a paper in any field, the paper that you publish, or even the book that you publish, describes the head of a pin of research. And when you're writing that paper, you rarely describe even the tip of the pin, right? Let alone the whole pin, let alone the pin cushion or the table the pin cushion is on. And when you talk to a smart person who is coming to take a class from you because they want to bring some of that insight back to their workplace, you have to give them the whole context in which your expertise lies, which forces you to take a step back and think about, wait a second, how do all these pieces fit together? Not just that little bit that I study. How does that relate to the adjacent things? How does that relate to, you know, so I can't, as a psychologist, I can't just focus on, you know, whatever my particular areas of research might have been, you know, focusing on how people judge the similarity of things, or what information they use to categorize, or what were some of the factors that influenced decision making. I had to take a step back and say, how do people think? You know, and what's going on with that thought process that might derail it in an organizational setting, because that's the thing that that 45-year-old wanted to know when they were sitting in my class. And that changes the way that you think about your own expertise.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. I think that cross-pollination, when you get business people coming back into your system, and once they've absorbed, like you said, the ways of business. I had a friend in grad school in Florida who was a Cuban immigrant, like a Bay of Pigs Cuban immigrant, like got in, you know, barely, and was a business guy there, and came back because he was a really smart dude and very interested just in intellectual activity. But he told me once, he goes, yeah, you Americans don't do politics. He goes, nobody's coming to get your family. Nobody, you know, around you has died because of political beliefs. None of this is real. It's all just fiction politics. And I'm like, yeah, I never really thought of it that way. But his, you know, he had lived his entire life in politics, yeah, not as an abstract concept, but as, hey, you got to survive within this, you know, particular world. Yeah. And so I think businesses are really good at, like you said, forcing you to heighten and sharpen and, you know, show how your stuff is useful in the, you know, the real world with that stuff.
Yeah.
I think entertainment, again, sort of what I do, like cross-pollinating entertainment over into education. I've had this discussion even with Rod Hart a couple of times about how come education doesn't, you know, harvest the production techniques and all this stuff more from Hollywood, because they figured out all these things about riveting attention. You know, and, you know, even the problem in Hollywood is that they have to do so much entertainment that they can't handle the pico depth of education. Yeah. So everything just skims along the surface, hit, 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 move, move, move. But there's a sweet spot somewhere in the middle, I think, when you start cross-pollinating those things. And that's, again, why I really like doing this podcast, and I enjoy that format, because it can handle, like, yeah, these are entertaining conversations, especially to me. But there's, yeah, a lot of content in here, too.
But you know, one of the things that I think education needs to do is to learn not just from the entertainment, how do I get your attention, but also, you know, how do I learn from what video games are doing? Because video games are not just it's not just entertaining, it's engaging.
It's a stimulation industry. That's probably a better way of thinking of it.
And people have to do some work. And in order to stay engaged, in order to improve, in order to jump a level. And you know, I think that that part of what we need to do is to learn more about that kind of engagement, but then embed that in a structure in which people understand what it is that they're trying to accomplish through their education. So one of the places where, one of the places I think where education diverges from Hollywood is that, you know, a great movie is one where the pieces fall into place at the end or just after the end. You know, I mean, whether, you know, whether it's something like The Sixth Sense, where you take a mediocre movie and make it a decent movie by a reveal at the end that nobody catches on to, or whether it's a movie that that where the final scene brings all the pieces together so that you continue to think about it later. But in education, we really want you to know where we're, where you're going from the beginning. We want to explain to you, this is the journey you're embarking on, and this is what you're, this is why you're doing this thing right now. And there will be moments of discovery along the way, but those moments of discovery shouldn't be about what your education is about. That needs to be laid out clearly. And I think we actually have drawn some of the wrong lessons from literature and movies, and we sometimes turn our classes into a mystery novel, where we want to engage people and then at the end reveal what it was they were supposed to have learned, instead of saying, look, this is what this class is about. My job is to get you there by having you work with me, and then use the lessons from Hollywood, the lessons from video games, to create the level of engagement and work that's required to really learn something, because real work is frustrating, you know, and think about, you know, Angry Birds, right? You know, you get those levels in Angry Birds where you just can't get the darn last pig to blow up, and you're frustrated by that, but you then figure something out and you stick with it. That level of frustration is actually really critical for learning something. Unfortunately, we embed that mostly in learning how to blow up little pigs, which doesn't have any redeeming social value. But if we could get people to put in that same level of effort and enjoy that level of frustration as part of the education experience, they would emerge at the other end of that with some really valuable knowledge and skills.
Yeah, and I think you hit on it there. The real secret inside of Hollywood is not about story or images and all that stuff. It's about emotions. Like, it's an emotional artistry, and the amount of emotions that you experience in anything that's been produced, from a game version to music to film, if you actually tracked it, like in a great song, the amount of emotions that you're taken through, it's hundreds. It's incredible, incredibly textured emotional experience. And I don't think most people approach their lectures that way.
No, you know,
it's a cognition, right? You know, it's not of an emotional experience for the students. It's a cognitive experience.
Well, I think most people don't understand what emotions are, right? Emotions are the readout of where your motivational system is at any given moment. And so you can't have an emotional experience with something you're not motivationally engaged with. And so part of the problem is if you teach in a way that is only about the information, then you get a kind of dispassionate view of that from the part of the students. But what that dispassionate view creates is a lack of engagement. You know, if you think about, you know, if you've ever, you know, you've been to academic conferences are not boring, because you get people who care deeply about a subject matter who will sometimes literally be yelling at each other in a hotel ballroom about something that there's only eight other people on planet Earth who care about it. But the yelling is a reflection of motivational engagement. This is so important to me that I am going to yell at you about this topic. And that in that level of engagement is critical for really trying to learn something. It has to feel like a life or death enterprise, you know, and it's, you know, it's funny. People say a lot, you know, to college students, find your passion. I hate that phrase.
Yeah.
But what we should be saying is find your engagement. If you can find something that you can't wait to get back to because you want to engage with it, that's what matters. It's not, I don't have to love it. I just have to want to be in it and active in it and doing it. That's what really matters. And we, you know, I think we are so focused on just, can I get you the right information? You know, I another one of my lines here is that, you know, it's unfortunate that what we try to do is to try to create bright, creative students by making sure that everybody gets the same answer on the exam.
Sure.
You know, and I think what we have to do, and that's cold, right? That's all about the information. If we create classes that are more about the process by which you do things, then you create more engagement, because it's not about getting the right answer. It's about doing the right things. If you do the right things for long enough, you will come up with some really great answers. And that gets back to what you were saying earlier about going into the writer's room. The writer's room works because it's the right process. Even if the first 12 things you throw out are wrong.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good way of looking at it too, like these discovered processes that business and different businesses will develop. And like, yeah, we do it this way because it works. I remember when I co-learned stand-up in my early 20s at the same time I was co-learning how to lecture. Mm-hmm. So I was running both of those all, you know, at the same time. And stand-up, the one thing you learn, the coolest thing about stand-up, I think, is it's the most dense form of public discourse there can be. It's a laugh every 7 seconds. And it's not just a ha-ha, it's a gut bust, you cannot not laugh at it, quality of laughs. And so it's this incredible high bar for emotional experience for the audience. And you're supposed to, once you get really good at it, get up there for 45 minutes to an hour, never let the energy out of the room. And it's a super training model for understanding what it is to kind of orchestrate emotions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like stand-ups will learn like when to start the next joke so that the laugh doesn't die from the first joke. And it's about 2/3 of the way through the laugh, you start mm-hmm. your next joke, because you never let them laugh out because it lets energy out. So I would go back into, you know, where I was teaching at the University of Louisville, and I kind of had to turn those lessons off in some ways because it was too much for the students. Mm-hmm. You know, I would do a lot of emotional elicitation, and I have tons of techniques because I learned them all in stand-up. I would bring them over to the class, and every once in a while I'd start to say something like, oh, no, that's a heckle or a response. I can't go that, you know, that deep, that quick. They can't handle it. Yeah. But I think that's why I talk about the positives, I think, of cross-pollination, which sounds like what you're looking at as, you know, as your job right now. Like, how do you bring these things together and let them infuse the new university? It's really exciting.
Yeah, it's great fun to me. And I, you know, the beauty of working at a university is I get bored easily. And so I've been able to change my job. I've been able to change what I do every 5 to 7 years throughout my career and I've only had two employers in that period of time. So I spent 5 years working at Columbia University in New York, starting in 1993, came to the University of Texas in 98. Now it's the tail end of 2021, and I'm, you know, so 23 plus years later, I'm still here. But in that time period, you know, I've been a regular professor, you know, writing papers that get read by my 30 closest colleagues and teaching my classes. And I developed a program and ran that program, and I ran a think tank, and now I'm in administration. I spent a year in there running the COVID planning process. That was a whole other thing. But you know, it's wonderful to be in an organization that allows you to try out so many different things without having to go out on the job market in order to do it.
Yeah. That's the fascinating part of universities. Like I remember the 2 years I was there getting my master's degree at UT, just how it felt just like you're just surrounded by resource.
Yeah.
You know, you knew as you're walking across the campus, like here are all these classrooms, who knows who's in there you know, talking, like I took a course from James Canavy when he was there, and he had been a monk for 35 years in the Catholic order and came out and was this, you know, amazing Greek scholar nobody ever heard of. And you're like, I just took a class from him just for fun. And it's like,
right,
that kind of resource, if people really understood, you know, the depth of what universities have, it's just, it's almost indescribable.
Well, and I think that not only the depth of the resource, but the depth of real discourse that happens here. You know, I mean, we're surrounded now by, you know, people who think that universities are somehow bastions of only a single mode of thought, you know, and
yeah, it's crazy, right? That's not.
And I think if you look at, I mean, you know, I helped to create a program here called the Human Dimensions of Organizations that takes the liberal arts, the humanities, social and behavioral sciences, and applies them to business. And the idea is let's teach people about people. And if I look at the range of people who taught in that program, you know, compare people in comparative literature, philosophy, classics, sociology, anthropology, psychology, religious studies. I mean, it was this wide range of people. Interpersonally, we had people of every particular political persuasion, you know, just it ran the gamut. And these are all just people at the university. We're colleagues. We get along, you know, even though we don't see eye to eye on all sorts of things. And I think that the caricature that people, you know, throw out about the way that universities work is 100% not a reflection of what's actually going on inside. And frankly, I believe a certain amount of that misperception is our fault as universities. I think we have not done a good job of explaining to people what we do, how we do it, what we're trying to accomplish, what really goes on here day to day. And so we have seeded the ground of the narrative about how universities function to people who have particular political points that they're trying to score. And I think we need to do a much better job of helping people to understand what we do. And part of the way that you do that is by teaching a broader range of students. The more people who come back at the age of 40 or 45 or 50 to take a couple of classes at the university because it's going to benefit their career, the fewer people who are going to be susceptible to hearing that universities have only one way of doing things, because they will know from their personal experience that that's not the case.
Yeah. And I, again, as a rhetorician, I look at sometimes these as big battles of the titans. You know, yeah. So the university kind of needs a better rhetoric of the university, right? Like you're saying, yeah. It needs to be able to explain itself explicitly and convincingly, even to people that don't have any experience with it. And because it doesn't do that, and because universities, again, I think like you said, they're all satellite, it's all balkanized, it's not under one umbrella. So you can pick them off, you can pick individual yeah. professors off, and there's no real political system in place to fight, you know, so that the universities can organize a fight against politics. No. And so politics, they're vandals. That's what they do. They find vulnerabilities in systems and they exploit them. That's the nature of that kind of talk. And so education has been vulnerable for a long time. And every once in a while, they find something like critical race theory and they're like, let's drag this out and look at all the political yeah. capital we can get out of it. And you hear professors get on, I see a lot of them on Twitter that I follow, and they'll talk about, you know, the internal workings of why this is so wrong, but that doesn't ever get to the media. You know, that never gets into the arena where these battles are being fought. So it's kind of interesting to look at it from, you know, from where I'm at, which is having, you know, moved through a lot of these different things and now kind of sitting out here independently and maybe yeah. doing some media work about it. But it's, you know, talking to somebody like you and doing this podcast, like if somebody were to watch this, how could they possibly say, oh, that guy's just a liberal, you know, just hates America.
You know? Yeah. No, that's right. And I think, you know, you need that level of engagement. And that's actually the place where getting beyond the soundbite matters. because you have to actually really dig in and talk to people and find out, you know, what they care about and actually have conversations, which is the other piece. You know, I think we consume a lot of media, but we don't converse much. And I think that's a shame because a lot of times, well, the thing about conversation is fundamentally you have to find common ground with somebody when you talk to them, because I can't understand what you're saying if we don't think similarly, at least in that moment. I have to wrap my head around what it is that you meant in order to understand what you're saying. And so in that moment, you and I have to think the same way. Even if I disagree with you, I have to think the way you are. And that means that I leave every conversation thinking more similarly to the person that I just spoke to than I did when I started that conversation. And that's very different from what has to happen when I just listen to other people having a conversation, because I don't, you know, anybody listening to this podcast does not have to think the same way as you or I, because they don't have to then say something that contributes to the conversation after that.
Yeah, that's true. Do you know the platform Lunch Club?
No, I don't know that one.
You got to check it out because it's right at the heart of everything that you're doing. So Lunch Club before the pandemic was an app that lets strangers who have similar occupation or interest meet for lunch, 45 Oh, cool. minutes. And it's got an algorithm where it matches people up. Pandemic hit, it all became Zoom. And it's a really interesting juncture. I try to tell people this from kind of a media studies perspective, between real life, where you have to have face-to-face conversations, and social media. Mm-hmm. They used to do a thing on the weekends that they called happy hours, where they just throw you around the world for 15-minute conversations with people. And suddenly, you know, I'm talking to a guy in a cab in the back of a cab in Mumbai, mm-hmm. who's a business guy. And we have a quick 15-minute conversation, and it takes that flatness of social media, the alienation inside social media, and rescues enough live communication to bring it into kind of a real communication zone. And I got so fascinated with it. I did over 500 of them and took notes on them.
Nice.
I'm like, this is something interesting and new. And like when you talk about education, sort of harvesting from all these new possibilities with technology, I'm like, that's something I think that's going to end up really interesting.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I will have to check that out. I like that idea.
Yeah, I'll send you an invite. You can get on it easily, but it's kind of an invite-only marketing system. But
cool.
But cool. Well, we've been talking for an hour. I'm going to let you go because you're a busy dude. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks. No, this was great fun. I'm glad we had a chance to do this.
Yeah. And so everybody can find you at the University of Texas and promote your KUT podcast a little bit.
Sure. I do a show called Two Guys on Your Head. If you listen to NPR, it's sort of like Car Talk, but for the mind. So the best part is it's only 7.5 minutes long. So you don't have to make a big lifetime investment to listen to it. But you can find it wherever podcasts are available. And I'm on Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and all that. I've written a couple of books so you can check me out there. I write pretty regularly for Fast Company and Psychology Today and Harvard Business Review. So always awesome. Trying to share what I know.
Yeah. Sounds like you're doing a good job of it. I appreciate you and the work you are doing. Thanks for jumping on. Once again, everybody, this has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast with Art Markman, and get out there and persuade some people. As always, they need it.